CliffCentral.com.
It's a little Justin Timberlake for you this morning. Not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. It wouldn't be a bad thing if the president did decide to take us to level two or even just scrap the whole lockdown altogether, but we'll get to that just now. In the burning platform, I got a great email from Allison, who sent me a quote that she read in a newsletter that arrived on her desktop this week. She said, and it's a quote from Benjamin Franklin. It made her think of the show. She said, "Any society that will give up a little liberty to gain a little security will deserve neither and lose both." Very, very good point. That's from Benjamin Franklin. And Allison, thanks for sending that on to us. Useful thing to think about this morning when our liberty is always in the offing and when we have to rely on each other to keep pushing back against government so we can retain some of that liberty. It is just after 7 o'clock, cliffcentral.com on a Thursday morning, which means the burning platform. We'll get to that in a moment. I'm very excited to welcome Phil Craig. And we'll talk about what an independent Cape might look like. And we'll talk about some of the things that could be obstacles to that happening. We could talk about the poll that was released just recently and how that's looking. So Phil is going to be our guest in the Burning Platform just now. Definitely someone I've been looking forward to talking to for a very long time. But before we get to that, let me remind you that also a little bit later today, if you have the time to join us, and you could do it live if you would like to, we're presenting the second in our Stop to Start webinar series with ABSA. And we're looking at sexual and gender-based violence, obviously a major problem in South Africa. And we're looking at that at 11 a.m. We'll be speaking to Hermin Boetes, Nadine Martha, and to Andrew Davies about sexual and gender-based violence in the corporate workplace, which is something that doesn't get the attention it should. Apparently happens far more than most of us would like to know or admit. So hang around for that. You can sign up now. Make sure you register, please. Go to cliffcentral.com. It is free to register. We're not going to ask you to pay to be part of this webinar, but it is with ABSA and Cliff Central, and it is Stop to Start, our second in the series. Join us for that at 11 a.m. this morning. Make sure you register before that, though. Okay, so we're going to get Canton Pillay in as our returning champion in this morning's Burning Platform. The Burning Platform, as always, brought to you by Nando's. It is it's something which we're very proud of. It's 6 years old and some months, and we've been talking about current affairs, all the things that matter to you. This morning, we're going to be joined by Phil Craig. Let me give you a little introduction to Phil. If Brexit was the result of ordinary British citizens bringing the politicians that lead them to heel, then Cape Independence is its South African cousin. Politicians beware. These are the words of Phil Craig, co-founder of the Cape Independence Advocacy Group, that is pushing for the people of the Cape to be able to elect their own government and to be able to hold that government to account, something most of us have lost the ability to even imagine. It's definitely a different perspective to what we're used to hearing in the mainstream media. So this morning I thought we'd have him on the Burning Platform. So welcome, Phil. Very nice to see you, and thanks for joining us this morning.
Morning, Gareth. Morning, Canton. Thank you very much for having me. It's good to be with you.
Thank you. Canton Pillay, how are you this morning? Let's see if we can get Canton back on. Maybe Canton must go and then come back. Anyway, Phil, let me start with you because I've been waiting to talk to you for a long time. So you are a serial entrepreneur, you're co-founder of the Cape Independence Advocacy Group, and you're working towards effectively creating a Cape of Good Hope, which would be a first world country at the southern tip of Africa, bringing freedom, security, and prosperity to all who live there, regardless of their race, religion, or culture. Is that a fair assessment, or are people already trying to demonize your reputation by saying, no, no, you sound like some kind of Orania of the Western Cape?
Well, I think your assessment was perfect, and I think you picked some quotes that captured the essence of who I am and what we are as a group perfectly. And naturally, clearly this is something that will upset several in the establishment, and therefore are we demonised? And of course we are. You know, that campaign, that the more successful we are, the more that we get the narrative into the sort of mainstream conversation, the more those attacks have been ramped up. And that's fine. We really don't mind that. That was inevitable.
Tell me about these poll results that were released just the other day. These are very interesting, and these poll results will tell us something about how people in the Western Cape actually feel. Because if we don't start with having a majority of people in the Western Cape starting to warm to this idea, there's no point, right? It's just it's pie in the sky.
Sure. Look, so we haven't actually released the poll results. We're going to release the main poll results in September. We've started to release the side issues, let's call them. There's a great wealth of polling data, and rather than release everything in one go and have it sort of disappear into sort of one news cycle, we're releasing data over a period of a couple of weeks. So the first articles are coming out this week. So there should be one in News 24 that they should be running this week.
Mm-hmm.
Which basically talks specifically about the position of the DA, that based around some of the polling data that shows that if were the DA to oppose Cape independence, they would potentially and quite likely lose their majority mandate in the Western Cape. So that was quite a significant article.
Hold on, say that again, because the DA have made it very clear that they up to now have been opposed to the idea of a Western Cape independence, huh?
Sure. Look, so I think we have to sort of, it's a more simple, a more complicated question than it would first seem. You know, obviously the DA isn't one single organization. So, it comprises one, it has a federal structure itself, and therefore people within the DA who are in the Western Cape inevitably are going to have different feelings from those in the DA that are outside of the Western Cape.
Right.
And then even inside of the Western Cape, there are going to be people who associate more strongly with this notion that the DA is going to build this coalition government and remove the ANC from power and bring their vision to the rest of South Africa. And I think the reality is many of us would love to save the whole of South Africa. It certainly would be my choice. I always describe myself as a reluctant independent supporter rather than a sort of a devotee. If South Africa wasn't in the situation it was in, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But South Africa is in the situation it's in.
But it's all playing into your narrative here, because if the ANC were running the country beautifully and everything was hunky-dory and we hadn't also just been through a really, really traumatic lockdown, which has cost people jobs and livelihoods, then we...
Excuse me, Gareth, we're still in this lockdown, I just want to point out.
All right, thank you, Canton, stating the obvious, which we'll get to in a second. But this is all playing into your hands, Phil, because the worse the ANC get, the more likely the people of the Western Cape will say, well, for God's sake, we'll take anything other than this.
Yeah, for sure. But I think it's important that people, one of the accusations people say is, look, Cape independence is all about rejecting the ANC. And that slightly is incorrect, because the nuance is slightly wrong. It's about the Western Cape being able to elect its own government and hold that government to account. So the ANC is the symptom rather than the cause. Let's say the ANC lose power and EFF come to power. Has our situation improved any? Is independence then a reaction to the EFF rather than the ANC? And sure. Actually, so independence is the fact that for 26 years, the people of the Western Cape have never given the ANC a majority. And there's a really scary statistic that says, had every single vote cast in the Western Cape since 1994 been cast for the DA, then the ANC would have been the government anyway. So therefore, the people of the Western Cape don't actually have meaningful democracy. Whoever we vote for, we get the ANC. Or let's correct that. Whoever we vote for, we get whoever South Africa wants, and the Western Cape is rendered redundant. So we've got nothing against South Africa, and we've got nothing against the voters of South Africa. They have a right to elect whoever they want to elect. That, if they want the ANC, and they clearly do, then that is their decision. We're a democratic organisation, and although we don't agree with that choice, we respect the right to make it. The important thing is the people of the Western Cape haven't made that choice, and we're trying to reject them at every twist and turn.
I'm pretty sure that most people in the world would favor governments that are closer to the people in 2020 than these big super and supranational bodies. There may be a few, globalists who still think that there's an idea on the horizon in the offing for a global government, but I don't see that happening, and there are too many competing interests. And government can only really be effective when it is closest to the people. But I want to hear what Canton thinks of this, because actually we've never discussed this issue of Cape independence, but it seems to be becoming a very sexy topic lately, and there are more and more people who are starting to look at it and take it seriously. What do you think, Canton?
I think that this is fundamentally about the quest for federalism at its most fundamental level, which is the ability to give as much power as we possibly can, devolving down to the level of local communities. And if you use that as your starting point, I think that that's going to be pretty much a global model for the way ahead. But understand at the same time that we have the ANC right now essentially following the Chinese model, which is increasing centralization, removal of power from each of the purportedly independent regions. You consider China, for example. Tibet is purportedly an autonomous region, but central government is enforcing its will there.
Yes.
Uyghur is theoretically an autonomous region, and that didn't work out very well for the Muslims out there.
No.
And, of course, Hong Kong right now is the thin edge of the wedge in terms of the stripping away of the last vestiges of individual rights.
Let's go to the far extreme. They still believe Taiwan belongs to them in Beijing, even though Taiwan has no interest in assimilating into mainland China.
Yeah, well, look, you know, from a historical point of view, Taiwan doesn't belong to either of them. It actually belongs to the native Formosans, who were exterminated by Chiang Kai-shek when he fled Mao's revolution.
Right.
And pretty much wiped out most of the native population. So it's kind of like saying that New Zealand
belongs to Jacinda Ardern. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, but having said that, the basic issue in terms of Taiwan goes back to Richard Nixon, who was the person who actually opened up this can of worms, because he forged the partnership with Red China. Mm-hmm. Firstly, to drive a wedge between Red China and the Soviet Union.
Right.
Secondly, to create effectively an offshore factory floor for the entire United States manufacturing industry that was devoid of human rights and labor rights and all of those things that interested liberals like myself are actually so fond of. And as a direct result of that, you've had the absurd situation that we get in any communist country where you remove the sense of agency from people to be able to act in their best interests. So let's take Cape independence as a very specific thing now. The single biggest issue for me in terms of the Cape right now is policing. I can't say this strongly enough. The ability to actually enforce law within the province is at the behest of central government. Central government has systematically defunded the police force in the Western Cape, which is why you have these situations in the Cape Flats where the gangs are able to run rampant. Because the ability of the Premier of the Western Cape to turn around and say, I want to be able to deploy police stations in the following area. I want to deploy police personnel in the following areas. That's non-existent. That is at the behest of Peki Kele. And, of course, Peki Kele has a very long middle finger. So using that as a very basic example, we need a breakup of power from central government. And I think that, you know, ticking the boxes in terms of independence is not necessarily going to achieve the same objectives, but it's a starting point in terms of this debate. I think it's an important debate.
Phil, let's just go straight to your utopia here. Let's imagine you manage to get a referendum. Let's imagine the people of the Western Cape decide almost unanimously. Let's say you get 90% votes saying, yes, we want to be independent. And then, you know, the national government has to relent. And let's say it all happens. Does that mean when I come to visit you, I have to have a passport? Does this mean you have complete sovereignty? Does it mean that you are going to send someone to the United Nations? Does it mean that Cape Town becomes a country with its own legislature, its own judiciary, its own executive? How will it be run? Have you thought about all of these things? Will it have its own power? Will it have its own police force, as Canton said? I mean, there's a lot to think about.
Sure, there is. And look, it isn't our job to answer all of those. Clearly, we have to consider those. You know, ultimately, we're an organization that's seeking democracy. So a lot of those decisions
You're not proposing that you guys, the Cape Advocacy, the Independence Advocacy Group, become the government. You're saying you just want to facilitate the process of independence.
Correct. And look, you know, within our group, we're cross-political, you know, so actually in our management structure, we pretty well all voted for different political parties, which is really inherently healthy to say you've got a group of people with different political views. But to give you a really good example, how would it work? Just look at what happens with Namibia. Namibia is already broken away from South Africa. Other than a currency, all of those things are there. So yes, we want to have an independent country that has its own border, has its own government, has its own systems. It will be entirely independent of South Africa, at which point we can be a really good neighbour and a trading partner.
All right, so it wouldn't actually be too complicated in your estimation.
Well, I think that probably would be a stretch. I think clearly it's going to be a complicated process, and I don't claim to have all of the answers. You know, that's something that obviously we're going to have to work through as we go.
What would be required to make this fantasy a reality?
Well, look, realistically, there are two things that are required to make independence happen. One is, which is the absolute fundamental, is the democratic will of the people. The majority of the people, and by the people I mean everybody who is a registered voter in the Western Cape, regardless of who they are, what colour they are, where they live, what political party they support.
Right.
So actually, everybody in the Western Cape, the majority of those must want to be independent. So that is one. That's the democratic will of the people. And in practical terms, two, is international recognition. We're going to need support from overseas. We're going to need international sponsors who say, we will stand up and we will support, we will recognise, in the correct term, we will recognise an independent Western Cape should you declare yourself independent. And between those two processes, I think we probably have to line both of those up. And then once to have them both lined up, then that is the conversation where we start talking about referendums, because the big question around the referendum and one of the big queries people have is, look, will the ANC allow this? And I think you have to look back at 1992 and say, you know, did the National Party walk willingly and freely into a referendum to end its rule? Of course it didn't. It wasn't a political vacuum, and it was subject to enormous external pressures which forced it to behave in a certain way. And I think with the ANC and Cape Independence, we've got exactly that situation. It will be external pressures and political pressures that will bring to bear on the ANC to force it to recognise the democratic will of the Western Cape, should it get to the point where the majority of people want independence. And obviously we're not there now. The majority don't want independence now. But when we do release the poll results, people are going to be quite surprised at what number actually do want it.
All right, so you're going to release these results in piecemeal over the next couple of weeks.
Sure.
And we'll obviously be watching as more and more of this information comes out. But I
assume... let's just put a bit of a historic context on this, though, Garrett. Just to, looking in terms of things that have happened, you know, in the past couple of decades. So first example that we need to take a look at is what happened in the former Yugoslavia.
Yes.
So... you had the referendum that essentially gave birth to Bosnia,
right?
Which and what was crucial in terms of that actually taking place was that you needed the support of the international community to make that happen.
Right.
Now contrast that with what happened in Crimea. Exactly the same scenario as happened in Bosnia. Exactly the same legal process happens.
Mm-hmm.
The people of the Crimea vote overwhelmingly that as a region, they want to become part of Russia.
Oh, yes, sorry.
Because remember, they want to separate from Ukraine and they want to become part of Russia.
Right.
So overwhelmingly, and again, you know, the numbers, all of that exactly the same. But what happens is you have international community that comes down and refuses to recognize it. Obama puts in place sanctions and of course the entire Russia hysteria dates back to exactly that point. You are not going to have a scenario right now where any country in this world is actually going to join forces with anyone who, in Palestine, for example, who declares a referendum, say we want independence, and we're declaring ourselves to be a country, and no one's going to recognize it. So anything that we try to do in terms of getting independence for any country anywhere in the world is entirely dependent upon getting a critical mass of people who are willing to support independence for that region. And I guess that's where the question then comes back in terms of Cape Independence. What is the international support that you guys have been able to get so far?
So look, it's too early in the process for that. Yeah, we are now 12 weeks old. Look, let's say we've got irons in the fire. We have countries. Look, specifically, the Kate's two largest trading partners are the UK and Netherlands. I was born in the UK and I'm a British citizen also.
I must disagree. The Cape's largest trading partner is Gauteng.
Okay. Well, that's true.
And we might. Okay. And you know what? Actually, Phil Craig, we might want independence too. How about that?
Yeah. Well, I guess what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander.
Right.
It'll be interesting to see how that unfolds. You know, so we have started processes, but it's very, very early in there. What's very interesting is in recent British history. The British government is almost obsessively devoted to the democratic will of the people. And actually, so if you look through their recent history, people often talk about the UDI of Ian Smith. You know, Margaret Thatcher was essentially an ally of Ian Smith. You know, she supported him in many ways, mm-hmm. but she refused to recognise the UDI specifically on the grounds that it was a minority government and the British government could not support a minority government. It must have majority support. But when Argentina invaded the Falkland Islands, the British government then said, you know, the wishes of the islanders are paramount. And because the islanders wanted to remain British despite that Argentina had invaded them, the British sent a task force halfway around the world to militarily retake the Falkland Islands.
Right.
If we look down to Scotland, there was no constitutional or legal obligation on the British government to give Scotland a referendum on independence, but the UK government gave them one willingly, and again it was a 50% plus one. The democratic will of the Scots must be recognised. If we look at the Northern Ireland agreement, the Good Friday agreement, in that, you know, there obviously there were some discussions around the unification of Ireland, and the one precondition that the British government insisted was written into the Good Friday agreement was the democratic will. The majority of Northern Irish people must consent to unification before it can happen. So the British government, post-colonialism, sort of post 60s 70s, have been absolutely devoted to this principle that the democratic wishes of the majority of a people is paramount. Mm-hmm. And therefore, that gives me great hope in our discussions, at least with the UK government, that given the historical ties, that if we have a clear mandate, and look, that is the if that we keep coming back to, we must get to that clear democratic mandate. But if we have one, then I think that we would be able to get support. It won't be an easy process, but from the UK government.
Sure.
I'm less familiar with the Netherlands government, but I suspect we'll find allies there too. Look, I've been pointed in the direction of several, but I've not arrived at their door yet. So.
All right, well, while you're still part of South Africa, let's just talk about what is on everyone's mind this week, because there was a story leaked yesterday about how the NCCC and President Cyril Ramaphosa are thinking very seriously about bringing us to level 2. How lucky we are. What is level 2, Canton? Do you even remember what it is?
No, level 2 in terms of the level of bullshit that we get, it means that the bullshit is more out in the open, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
Look, my entire thing around the reason why people leak information is that they want to start creating grounds for a narrative up front.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always inherently distrustful of leaked information, because right. when information is leaked, it is the person doing the leaking that is actually setting the agenda, not the journalists who jump up and happily parrot whatever is coming from that anonymous source. It comes without any sense of accountability whatsoever. It cannot be challenged on any public platform. And frankly, I don't believe it.
Okay.
So that is my starting point. We've seen this persistently in terms of the way in which the ANC engages with the rest of the world. We believe that we understand what goes on behind doors in Luthuli House. But frankly, the only person who historically has had any insight into what goes on in Luthuli House is Julius Malema. And he's been extremely quiet of late. So at the point at which Malema tells us this is what the ANC is doing, I'm likely to believe it, just simply because he's got a track record of being absolutely correct around that. So guys, let's not get hysterical about level 2 or any of those things. The fact of the matter is that our fundamental rights are trampled upon on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
We don't have the ability to unlock the economy. We have people who are losing their jobs every single day, and those jobs are not going to come back. We have had Heineken and breweries saying that they effectively pulling out 12 and a half billion rand of investment that was going to go into the local industry. And frankly, if I was either breweries or Heineken, I would not be looking at actually investing that money going forward, because consider that you don't know what's going to happen with this ANC government in terms of suddenly turning around with the new implementation of BEE that they gazetted fairly recently, which will then allow them to set ownership goals in terms of these big corporates as well. Why would anyone in their right mind be wanting to actually becoming putting more money into shoring up this corrupt government? I don't think so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's you're not giving us much to look forward to here, but then I suppose that that's been true for the entire lockdown. There are, though, I'm starting to feel that there's quite a lot of pushback. I mean, you mentioned SAB and you mentioned Heineken, but I think that the tobacco industry started to push back very obviously. There are certain people who've always thought that they had a seat at the table with government who've started to realize they really don't. Plus, we've seen the figures in the last couple of weeks of the projected revenue, which is just frightening, because SARS's revenue is taking a big, big dip on that chart. And their expenses continue to rise. There's got to be a point, though, where the rubber meets the road, even for ideologues and disconnected bureaucrats and people who have bizarre notions of how economies work within the ANC. There's going to be a moment where they look at the purse and it's empty. Don't you think, Canton? That'll be the moment that forces their hand?
Well, the purse has actually been empty for a while. We're already running off borrowings.
Yeah.
And the purse will actually, as I've said before, the purse will be empty when they've looted our pension funds. But consider that that we once again passed 18 rand to the dollar over the past couple of days.
Right.
Which is just go back about a month and we were sitting at around about 15.55 to the dollar. Now, consider what that means in terms of our ability to service our debt. Because remember, our debt is coming from outside our borders.
Right.
And that means that effectively we've got, close to a 20% hike in terms of the amount of money that we needed to be paying out over the past period. No, it's an absolute disaster right now. And this government doesn't have a clue in terms of what it should be doing. But what they are doing is doubling down, which is what they always do, on their failed policies and insisting, you know, like socialists around the world, that we will get it right this time. And they will get it right. And we will all be equal at the point at which all of the money runs out.
So in other words, they'll make us equal by making us all equally miserable and poor.
Exactly right. Yes, we're very fast getting to that stage. Look, the difficulty that we've got right now is there isn't enough of a critical mass of people who are feeling pain yet. And the reason for that is that the shrinking middle class that we have in this country is, by and large, still largely insulated from the effect of this. But as the bits and pieces of the economy that keep the flow of money going through to the middle class start drying up, which they have been doing, the pool of money that's available is going to be shrinking. And as that pool of money shrinks, there's going to be layoffs. And eventually those layoffs are going to filter through to most of the middle class, except for those that are employed by government.
Yeah. And
so where does that leave us?
So in other words, you're saying that pain is still coming.
Yes, the pain is still coming. And people are just actually not yet, they can't see the tsunami coming. But, you know, for those of us who are actually watching the figures, that tsunami is coming. But it's delayed.
Phil, do you have any comments on lockdown, and particularly your experience of lockdown in the Western Cape, where they keep telling us that the curve is now starting to flatten, the worst is over? In fact, William Kesey even said as much this week that the only place he's concerned about at the moment is KwaZulu-Natal. Is the the grip around the neck of the people of the Western Cape starting to loosen?
Well, okay, while you were talking, I'm just going to, there was a quote that came to mind as you were chatting there. So before I answer that, that was Margaret Thatcher's quote, was the trouble with socialism is that sooner or later you run out of other people's money. That's exactly what I was thinking. Yeah. Lockdown, I can't speak for other provinces because I haven't been out of the province. But I mean, what I would describe the Western Cape as having is probably the first couple of weeks that was kind of like a meaningful lockdown. And since then, you know, there hasn't really been a lockdown in any case. You know, I have now alcohol is delivered to my door rather than going to the bottle store. If I drive through the town, you know, the manual labor are standing 50 to the side of the road, all waiting for, regardless of what the regulations are. Furloughed my domestic worker, but obviously continued paying them, and I did shopping and took it into the township right to the heart of the thing to drop off supplies to them. Well, I mean, you know, when I went into to the township, you know, there was no notion that lockdown even existed. So right. What do I think of lockdown? I think absolutely nothing has changed. I think people have done what South Africans are absolutely brilliant at doing, which is just making a plan. We're so used to working around an incompetent government that lockdown is just one more obstacle that we've had to navigate, and I think people have navigated it remarkably well.
That's actually
I've got to say that actually absolutely nails it. You know, yeah. South Africans, we are so used to the blatant incompetence of our overlords that that's exactly what we've ended up doing.
But Canton, can't we rely on that incompetence in a way, because people talk about these doomsday scenarios and like a Zimbabwe that's on the horizon for South Africa. And I often say to them, well, I don't even think they're competent enough to mismanage us into something like that, because ordinary people in this country do, as just evidenced by what Phil said now, we do still have a lot of control over our immediate circumstances, over our neighborhoods, over our networks. And that all of that's going to be very difficult for these guys to control. They really don't have an ability to run anything, even to a tenth of the idea that they might have in their heads when they start trying to run it.
Well, consider the case of the farms as an example, and let's take the wine farms in the Western Cape.
Right.
Now, over the years, by and large, yes, you know, you'll hear the occasional beating in terms of exploitation of workers and so forth. But by and large, nearly all of the wine farms in the Western Cape happen to be well-run, happy spaces, mm-hmm. where workers are actually looked after and there's a fundamental respect for human rights.
Right.
And essentially, these have been miniature ecosystems that have existed in spite of government.
Yeah.
And they've continued to thrive. But what has happened right now is that the government has actually interfered with the fundamental underpinnings of the economical well-being of those ecosystems. So when you have a scenario where all of those wine farms are not able to actually process their product and sell their product, it means that that entire structure collapses, because the first thing that then falls apart is the ability of the owners to continue paying their workers.
Right.
At the point at which that happens, then you have starvation that then filters down through to the lowest echelon of that particular ecosystem. That ecosystem dries up and it doesn't get to recover. And the reason why it doesn't get to recover is because remember that these things, in terms of their cash flow, largely are reliant upon having an ongoing stream of money that comes into the ecosystem to ensure that it's able to continue operating. Assuming you have a scenario where this lockdown effect on the alcohol industry is lifted in 3 months' time, where is the money going to come from to recapitalize those farms? Is it going to come from government? No, because government has been very clear that it's only going to go to certain black-owned enterprises, and mm-hmm. that's only going to be obviously ANC-owned enterprises.
Right.
So use a single wine farm in the Western Cape as a microcosm of what happens in the rest of the country. And that is the disaster. Think in terms of every Airbnb establishment that has been operating, that has been shutting down. Think of every restaurant that has been shutting down. Mm-hmm. There is no money that is going to be available then kickstart those businesses again. Because no bank is going to turn around and say, yes, I'm going to lend you a few millions. People have built up these businesses over decades, centuries in the case of a lot of the farms that have actually existed in the Western Cape.
Sure.
These are not going to come back.
I think we've got to leave it there because there's so much other stuff going on in the world that I'd like to have your thoughts on. Phil, I don't know whether you're particularly interested in what's going on in America or not, but I know Canton is. So Joe Biden has chosen Kamala Harris as his running mate. Some people are surprised by this. Other people are not. We know that the shortlist was only for women of color. So we knew it was either going to be her or Susan Rice. Or, one or two of the less well-known candidates, including Stacey Abrams in Georgia and some others. But this is not necessarily a saving grace for Joe Biden anyway, because a lot of people are trumpeting it as some kind of victory for women when if your memory is that poor that you don't remember that a woman ran as president last time for the Democrats, then this is no major move. She's a woman of color, which obviously in intersectional politics is a big deal. But does she really bring anything special to the Biden ticket in respect of a voting bloc? I mean, are we going to see black voters vote for her? She didn't get black voters in the primaries.
This entire theory that people vote according to their race is so fundamentally flawed.
But this is what the Democrats believe, Canton.
Yes, I know. And the absurdity of it, never fails.
They thought that every woman in America would vote for Hillary Clinton just because she was a woman.
And overwhelmingly, women voted for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And it was men that voted for Hillary Clinton predominantly. Look, let's just say a couple of things about Kamala Harris. She's the daughter of she has a Jamaican father and she has an Indian mother.
Right.
Okay, so, and she's married, her husband is Jewish.
Yes.
Okay, so she ticks a lot of boxes for a number of core constituencies. Sure. Just this entire identitarian base. The Israelis are relatively comfortable with her based on the fact that she has had overwhelming support for Israel over the years, which again is not surprising.
That isn't a mainstream Democrat position either.
It is a mainstream Democrat position, but it isn't a fringe Democrat position. And you see, this is where it actually becomes fascinating, because if you drill down to the squad,
yes,
and well, the three members of the squad who so far have actually faced primaries, so there's Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, and now Ilhan Omar, mm-hmm. Have all won their primaries with larger margins than they did in the previous elections. So you actually are seeing a surge in terms of support for the squad and their particular politics. Mm-hmm. Because remember, we've also had within New York, we've had established Democrats that have been tossed out by up-and-coming identitarians.
Right.
Also more interesting for me is the fact that Ilhan Omar, and I never thought I'd send a shout-out to Ilhan Omar, but I'm doing so today, because she has refused to endorse Joe Biden. And I think that she's actually shown principle in terms of the way in which the entire Democratic establishment is actually working. You know, I fundamentally disagree with her politics at so many levels, but I respect the ability to actually not go with the flow. Now, if you look at the outpouring of adulation that has now followed the announcement with regard to Kamala Harris, first understand that this is a woman who on stage called Joe Biden a racist.
That's right.
Secondly, this is the woman who publicly came out in support of people who had accused Joe Biden of sexual impropriety.
Yeah, she said, I believe
them. And she said she believes them.
Yeah.
And yet she is now willing to step up to the podium and actually be part of his ticket. And say that he's the best person to actually run the country. What does that say in terms of her principles and in terms of what she actually ends up believing?
Says there are none, right, Phil?
There are none.
I agreed. Look, I'm not a great follower of American politics, but I'm an absolute fervent believer in principle. So yes.
So the endorsements that have flown in her direction. Well, Hillary Clinton was there immediately. Bill Clinton was there immediately. Barack Obama was there immediately.
Well. Yeah, he only really threw in some support for Joe after the primaries had already been wrapped up. So he didn't come to the aid of Joe at the time that Joe needed him.
Mm. But I think the interesting thing is going to be what actually plays out at the level of these smaller constituencies. Are we going to see a scenario where the likes of the squad, as an example, actually retain their seats? Because remember, the point around the primaries is to decide who becomes the candidate for the party.
Correct.
And then in the actual election, the parties then face off against each other.
Right.
And so the question becomes, yes, the squad have actually increased their majority, but are they going to be in a position to retain their seats? Mm-hmm. Because remember that AOC got elected last time with around about 17,000 votes.
Right, so it was very thin margin.
No, which is minuscule in terms of the U.S. So my take on this, I mean, right now my view is that I can't see Trump losing this yet.
Yeah, you kind of indicated that last time we spoke about this, but why is it? Because some people get annoyed when we talk about American politics too much. So much of what's happening this year is as a direct result of the fact that it is an election year. And when America gets a cold, when America sneezes, we all get a cold, right? And the American economy, if it starts to open up and it starts to grow again, and the indications, the early indications are that the American economy is just desperate to get going again. If that does happen, that plays right into Trump's hands, right? It works for him in every way.
Well, the economy has gotten going. I mean, if you look in terms of the job figures that are coming out of the U.S., the number of jobs that are being added on a monthly basis. But remember, I said this at the start, because one of the strengths of the American economy is the ability to hire and fire people at will.
Right.
With the start of the economy, what they did was there were mass layoffs that took place. Mm-hmm. And immediately at the point at which the economy starts opening up, what do you have? You suddenly have mass hirings taking place.
Yeah.
Now, imagine the scenario, that scenario being applied in our country, because we had a situation where businesses have basically taken it on the chin and have needed to continue paying workers for this entire period by law. And look, don't get me wrong, there are many businesses that have actually, that could have gone the route of immediately starting to retrench workers, and they didn't. And I think that the businesses that actually ended up doing that, I actually had respect for them for not going through that process. Yeah. But on the other hand, if you think about businesses like the hospitality industry, for example,
sure,
where the ability of those businesses to actually survive this, if they had been able to fire their workers up front and then start rehiring them when the economy opened up, we would have had a chance of those jobs actually existing at this time come next year, and that's not going to be happening. So going back to the U.S. scenario, I think that right now, remember that survey that we quoted last week that was talking about the fact that the majority of people in the U.S. are afraid to speak their mind because they're afraid of cancel culture.
Correct.
Okay, and contrast that with surveys that where, you know, people ask them, are you going to be voting for Trump? And it shows Biden ahead in the polls. And remember, that was exactly the same scenario that played itself out at the time of Clinton versus Trump 4 years ago.
That's exactly right. In other words, yeah, people were lying to the pollsters. But there's something else that's happening, and it's something that we saw a small spark of in the Western Cape just yesterday, which is why, Phil, you might want to comment on this too. But we know that the Democrat cities, the big cities in America, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, and Portland, just to name a few, have all experienced these protests and riots over the last few weeks. Some people have called half of the people there protesters because they very legitimately were upset about police brutality in the beginning, but it's turned into riots. I mean, Chicago had to close the Magnificent Mile because it became a train of looting through the center of one of America's major cities. These are all Democrat-run, all of them, and they're all cities that have said that they want to start defunding the police. Now, there's a pattern emerging here, and it's a very destructive pattern. It almost feels like it's being coordinated from somewhere. Just yesterday, I saw there was a march in Stellenbosch. It was supposed to be a protest. It was poorly attended. It didn't really go anywhere, but there was some very worrying undertones of violence and killing of people and all kinds of other things. It didn't amount to very much in the end. But can you comment on either of those, the local situation and the situation in America? And is there a link at all, or am I grasping here?
Yes.
You want to go ahead?
Sorry.
You want to start?
No.
I mean,
No. As I say, my knowledge of American politics is very limited, so I'm not going to draw any comparisons. I'm happy for Canton to.
Canton, go ahead.
No, I'm reluctant to draw those comparisons, Garrett. You know, consider the Stellenbosch March was what purportedly organized by the PAC. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, you know, obviously I wasn't in Stellenbosch, and so I don't have firsthand experience of what was actually going down there. Mm-hmm. And the PAC currently, in terms of their support base, has, what, one seat in Parliament?
Yeah.
Nationally, I'm surprised that they actually still exist as a party. I really can't see them existing after the next election. And, you know, so again, you ask yourself, the PAC in a part of the world where they have almost non-existent representation, why actually hold a march in Stellenbosch? Well, it's because it's a place where they are guaranteed to get the most visibility in terms of publicity. Okay. Versus the scenario that you have in the United States, where there's a very high stakes game that is being played for actually controlling the power structures in the entire country. And let's be very clear, the big money in the United States right now, in terms of politics, is very firmly behind the Democratic Party. Okay. Because to a large extent, what you are seeing is the Republicans actually stripping the underpinnings of the power structures of those companies. Now, consider, for example, the manufacturing base of a company like Apple.
Yep.
As an example, all of that has been based in China.
Correct.
And under Trump, you've had a scenario where he's been forcing those jobs to come back to the United States, obviously at great cost to Apple. Because the fact is that workers in the United States, you know, because of our damn liberal labor laws, actually end up earning decent wages versus people who end up assembling iPhones up in China. Jeff Bezos, for example, is one of the biggest backers for Kamala Harris. As a very specific case in point. Now, think back to something that actually happened over the past recent period. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys have been actually following what's been happening on the front, but consider what Apple has done in terms of the upcoming release for the iPhones, for iOS 14. They've done something very significant. They've actually upped the ability of individuals using iPhones to control their own privacy. Now, what does this mean?
They have?
They have, okay. So let me put this in perspective. Okay, right now, what happens in a number of these ecosystems, every time you end up accessing a particular piece of information, there's a unique identifier tag that gets recorded based on the fact that you have seen that particular thing.
Right.
And that tag will then filter through into other environments. So if you consider Facebook's ecosystem, if you happen to reference a post on Facebook and then hop across to Instagram, mm-hmm. And that unique identifier is actually embedded in that particular piece of information.
It links the two.
It links the two, and they're able to track you across platforms. Then when you go across to a banking site, mm-hmm. and you're making a transaction on the banking site, and they can't see what the transaction is on the banking site, but that ad is on the side of the banking site potentially, and they're able to tell that you're going into the space. So these little atoms of information actually follow you across the internet.
Right.
And what Apple has done in iOS 14, which is not most people haven't downloaded it yet, but it is there. Every time one of these...
There's a beta version out, yeah.
Yes, but every time this particular piece of information is going to be tracked across applications, Apple is now going to pop up a warning that says, by the way, these guys are actually using this specific piece of information across these platforms to track you. Right. Do you want to allow this?
Uh-huh.
And you as the person using the iPhone, will have the ability to opt out.
That's very good.
Which I think by and large people will actually tend to do. What does this mean for the ecosystem of someone like Facebook? There's a massive financial impact on people like Facebook because their ability to monetize their audience is actually dependent upon them being able to digitally crawl up your sphincter and be able to see exactly everything that's going on in your life.
All right. I just wonder if you don't mind, go back to Phil while we've got him here. So, Phil, your poll results, you say you're going to be releasing over the next couple of weeks. I'm sure there'll be all kinds of interesting information in that. Have you at all engaged with any of the political parties? And what did the ANC have to say about this? What did the DA – you said that there's a bit of a schism there in terms of some of the DA people are for it, some are against it, so they have to resolve that themselves. But have you been speaking to other political actors as well?
Sure, we have. So look, so just tying that back together, you talked about the PAC. So let me give you an interesting quirk. Obviously, understanding that Patricia de Lille started her life at the PAC.
Yeah.
The second highest support for CAPE independence is amongst the Good Party. They something like, and I'm just looking to find the number. I think it's 63% of Good Party voters want full on independence. So, which puts Patricia de Lille in a very interesting situation now that she's sitting in the ANC cabinet, and we know she's been a political chameleon. So let's see what she's going to do. And we talked about the prosperity. 78% of Good supporters feel that they will be financially better off in an independent Western Cape. So there's lots of really interesting quirks that are there. Answering your question, yes, we've engaged with a number of political parties. We haven't engaged with the ANC at this point. There hasn't been an awful lot of point. We obviously engage primarily, our main target is the DA, given that they're the provincial government, and we've engaged with multiple people. And I think there's a quote actually that's coming out in an article that will be in the Daily Friend sometime this week from an MP. So we had an interesting quirk that within the DA we have been able to suggest there's a DA MP that specifically wants to lead the independence debate and is waiting for the all clear to be able to sort of come out. So yeah, you have this situation in the DA that at grassroots level there is extensive support. Our poll confirmed. Look, the Cape Party ran a poll in 2019 that showed that 66% of DA voters wanted a referendum on independence. Our poll shows that it's 65%. So there's two credible polls. So, wow. So the majority, two-thirds of DA voters want a referendum on independence. So the DA are in an interesting situation, and that obviously is reflected within their members too. You know, the members of the DA aren't devoid from the same questions. Yeah. And the very interesting quote, this DA MP who's waiting for the green light to be able to come out and say, I'm the person that wants to lead this internally and externally. I was asked, could I reveal this person's name? And look, I'm a very principled person, and so before I did anything, I went back to this MP and said, look, you know, I'm being asked from elsewhere in the DA. Can I reveal your name to them?
Right.
Which the person said to me, and I thought this was a very, very telling quote. Phil, you can reveal my name to anybody in the DA who has served in either provincial government or city government, because anybody who has served in provincial government or city government knows just how disastrous the relationship with the ANC is, and will understand instinctively why independence is essential. So that is from the heart of the DA. Look, and we talk extensively to wow. members of the DA. What is very noticeable is that they don't particularly at the higher levels talk to each other. But because I think everybody's waiting to see who's going to go first. And when the poll comes out, look, I'm not going to give the number now, and I'm still offended, but let's just say that the DA are going to be in a very, very uncomfortable position. And the fact that 66% of their voters want a referendum is by no means the worst number that's going to come out for the DA. They are going to be between a rock and a hard place. And Alan Windey at this point in time is very, very vocal on, I'm a South African first. I'm this. The people of South Africa. And actually, Alan Windey seems to be entrenching himself in a situation where he is opposing to himself to independence. I don't know whether that's... And he seems a really principled person. I don't know. Alan has refused to talk to us. He's refused to meet us. But he's in a situation where at some point, and very, very quickly, he's going to come up into direct confrontation with the people that elected him. And Alan Windey has to remember that he isn't there because Alan Windey was just the chosen one. He was elected by the people of the Western Cape, and he was elected by DA voters. And in the same way as if Patricia de Lille is going to sit in a situation where two-thirds of the people that voted for her want independence, what's she going to do? Then Alan Windey is going to find himself in a not entirely dissimilar situation. Let's just say that. So, When these numbers come out, the political landscape is going to look quite different. The polling is very, very good. We're not holding it back because it's bad. We're holding it back because it's good, and we want to spread this. And you can kind of see this in the news cycles. Yeah, in the last 10 days, Chris Roper's written a hit piece. Max Dupree has written a hit piece. Pierre Voss even wrote a hit piece yesterday.
Yeah, but those three people you can pretty much put in the same category. I think they're almost exactly. They almost have a hive mind. It would be remiss of me to waste the opportunity. We've got Canton here. We've got you here. Canton has had experience of starting a party, and he knows that is a very hard and difficult process. I mean, Canton, if you had any advice for, obviously, you guys are just an advocacy group for independence. You're not a political party. But if Canton had any advice for you, what would you say his biggest obstacle might be?
Look, I think the biggest obstacle at this stage is actually getting enough of a critical mass in terms of the conversation to start talking about it. And the useful thing in terms of what they're currently doing is very much the same around the Brexit question, because Brexit was not about how it's actually going to be implemented. Brexit was all about, do we want to actually get the fuck out of the European Union? And it was a yes or no question. And binary questions are very cool in terms of actually appealing to voters, because this is really the simple thing. Do you want to be part of an ANC-run South Africa, or do you want to go it alone and sink or swim on our own? And I think that people can actually relate to that. And building a critical mass around that question, I think, is actually something quite fundamental. And I think the point that you guys are making around putting pressure on the DA to actually start looking at this question quite seriously, I think that's very useful. Is this an opportunity for the DA to start considering rewriting the constitution of the Western Cape? Because again, that is something within their power to do. And if they rewrite the constitution of the Western Cape in such a way that actually insists that greater power be devolving down to the provincial level, and the central government then refuses to accept that as a starting point, I think that becomes a stronger case for independence. So, but I think the binary question up front, do we want to leave or do we want to stay? Yeah. So that's your song to play out, Sia. Should I stay or should I go?
Beautiful. Well, gentlemen, we've gone over time, but thank you very, very much for being part of the Burning Platform today. The Burning Platform, as always, brought to you by Nando's. And it's worth me saying this, that they are fired up this morning at Nando's. Have you tried the Nando's curbside experience yet? I'll tell you what that is. You can get a takeaway without leaving the safety and comfort of your car. Yep. Order through the free Nando's mobile app and have your order brought out to you. That's if you are one of those people who doesn't want to go in unnecessarily to a shop, or maybe you don't like wearing a mask or whatever the reason might be. Go along, download the Nando's mobile app, have your order brought out to you. And if you haven't downloaded the Nando's app, you can do it now from all the good app stores. Very, very good. Phil, thank you so much. Phil Craig from the Cape Independence Advocacy Group, and of course, Canton Pele, who will join us again next week. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Very, very interesting show today.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, guys.
Good stuff. CliffCentral.com.